of the support infrastructure saying, okay, do this, do this, do this, do this, ask this question, do that, do that, do that. Take these tests, write down this information, draw a conclusion, send us the results, and we'll decide whether or not we pay you. On the other hand, over on the right, we have kind of the object mode, where you have a doctor object and a patient object, and they talk to each other. And to find out what's wrong with the patient, instead of following a bunch of procedures and tests and seeing the results, the doctor says, how are you feeling today? And you say back, well, I got this sore throat. The doctor says, really, how long have you had it? And you say back, no, oh, about a week and a half. And this goes on. And so we have two objects that are passing messages back and forth, right? They're saying, just holding this conversation, and this is how things work. Instead of having master control over there, establishing the process and telling everything how it's going to work, we have the objects that can do things for themselves and are working with one another, okay? So just kind of a different concept. So procedures are really familiar to us just because from a small age, this is how we tend to be taught, okay? So school teaches us to read and follow directions, right? And everybody did the exercise in elementary school where you're given a set of instructions and you're supposed to do them all, and so you do all these draw shapes and things on the piece of paper, and then the last instruction says, you know, the first instruction says read all the instructions before you do anything, and the last one says only do the third step, right? And so we get to the last step and everybody goes, oh, man. And so we're taught to do this procedural mode, this way of doing things, okay? We learn to read A to Z, 1, 2, 3, start to finish. That's just how we're taught to kind of work in the world, okay? Even though we live in an object world. So objects are familiar as well, because in terms of programming, they're just little models, right? So how many folks when they were kids built models of something? Probably most of the guys built models of things. All right, cool. Model cars, model planes, model trains, model whatever, right? So a model is a representation of the real thing, right? And so like model cars always never really had the one thing I really wanted them to have, and that was the ability to go, you know? They had that little thing that looked like a motor, right? But it never really did the things a motor was supposed to do. So it had a representation of the real thing, okay? But for purposes that we wanted to use it for, you know, to kind of look at the thing and be able to appreciate what the real thing was without having to spend, you know, well, back in that time, $5,000-$7,000 on a car. Those are the days. they served a purpose, okay? So the model is just a representation of the real thing. And we're just, like I said, we're surrounded by objects, okay? And we interact with them all the time. If we talk to a person, watch a dog run, we interact in an object-based world, okay? So we're observing objects in action, and we're interacting with other objects all the time. You know, here's a glass object. I can pick up the glass, and wait a minute, it rattles. So it can make a noise. The thing about object-oriented programming that tends to get people when they're first being introduced to it is it seems really unpredictable compared to procedural programming where we write all those instructions out, and we know where we start, we know where we end, and that's how it all works. This whole object thing is kind of like, well, okay, so we build a bunch of things and then we let them do some things, and that just doesn't seem like I'm in control anymore. It's just not quite the same. So it can sound a little bit intimidating. Hopefully by the time you leave today, it won't be at all. Okay, more procedures versus objects. Procedures control. Objects behave. Okay, so when we're interacting with a piece of data, for example, a procedure would say, set my color equals red. A procedure says, okay, that chair, make that chair's color blue. And there's the control, okay? From an object perspective, that chair has to be able to do the thing itself. So it has to have that behavior. So if I'm going to change the color of the chair, or if I want the color of the chair to change, the chair has to have a behavior, or a method, is the terminology we'll use, to change color. And what a a process can do, what part of the program can do is say, hey, chair, change your color and change it to blue. And the chair will say, either, okay, I know how to change my color, I'm now blue. Or, don't know what you're talking about, no can do. So I can't force the thing to do things that it doesn't know how to do. Objects behave, procedures control. Objects don't need to be scary. What is an object? Right now, I'm talking really in theoretical terms, so I'm not talking about a specific language or implementation. I will mention at this point, if there's a follow-on session that Josh Adams is doing that sounds eerily similar to this one. I can't remember the title, but it's also an OO thing. His is based on objects in CF with code samples and all that kind of good stuff. So after you're done here, if you want to take all the concepts you get here and plug them into CF, Josh's session is a great one to pick up. So anyway, so what is an object? An object is just a data type, like a string or a number, an int, a long, a float, or whatever. It's just a data type that can have properties and methods. Properties are the things that an object has, its characteristics, so we'll talk about that in a minute, and methods are what it can do, the actions that it can perform. Okay, so those are just the terms, properties and methods, what it has, what it does. Most languages that implement objects, once you have an object and you're handling it, you'll refer to it by whatever kind of object it is as the data type. So what's called the class for that object. So if we have an object class, again, well, I'll stick with my chair, of chair. When I'm manipulating an object of that class, it will be data type chair. So object is sort of a generic catch-all data type for any object that can be created within any given OO language. Once you actually have an object that you're working with in your code, you'll refer to it by its data type. So in this case, it would be of type chair rather than of type object. Okay. So properties describe. If the object is Jeff, Jeff has hair color and it's brown mostly, well, not much anymore, and eye color that's brown and a family that's Peter's. So those are characteristics that an object called Jeff might have. Okay. So those are my properties, or some of my properties. Pardon me? It's an old slide. Thanks, Bob. methods are procedures, a safe haven for all procedural programmers. The thing to understand is that you'll never get away completely from writing procedures just because you have to describe how things are going to work. Where procedures show up primarily in object-oriented environments is within the methods of an object. So what happens is instead of having a huge monolithic procedure that controls everything, you have little small procedures that are methods within objects, inside objects, that control what the object can do. So they're small, they're specific, they're much easier to maintain, and we'll talk about a little bit more about this in a minute, because the focus of each procedure has to do only with the object that it's attached to. So you don't have to worry about everything else that's going on in the application. This is one of the nice things about OO, and one of the reasons that you know the kids were supposed to be able to get it and did, is that it focuses very specifically on small tasks, on doing little things at a time. Instead of putting you into that situation where as a developer you have to have the whole application in your head and be thinking about, well, okay, if I do this, is it going to change something over there and all of that kind of stuff. So focus is much tighter. Really nice. The buzzword or the jargon for small is atomic. Very small stuff. All right, so a method example. I can walk, so I might have a walk method. Methods are always going to have parens at the end of them that indicate that this is a method. So if I see Jeff.walk, open paren, close paren, that indicates that the object Jeff has a method called walk. And if I invoke it by saying Jeff.walk, open paren, close paren, in most languages, then that will cause the object named Jeff to perform its walk method. Okay. going on. The parents are there, and that you can pass data into a method. And we're not going to get into great depth in that, but that's what the parents are about. So I might have a walk method that inside that method in the Jeff object, it says, lean forward, and until you want to stop, put out your left foot, put out your right foot, repeat. This is how we avoid falling down. So this is a lot easier than a procedure that says, okay, I need to look at Jeff there, and I say, okay, so I write a loop out in my procedure somewhere, right, that says, okay, I'll set a variable that refers to Jeff over there, and I'll say, okay, I want you to walk that way for so long and do these things, turn left, go right, you know, all of these sorts of things, as an outside controller, okay? It's a very simple, small procedure for a method rather than another process. You know, kind of think of how many people were just in here for Hal's session. Think of Hal up here, you know, behind me pushing my legs along, okay? That's procedural stuff, okay? He's saying, okay, walk over here. All right, and he's having to turn me everywhere. As opposed to standing over there and saying, hey, Jeff. And I say, hey, what? He says, walk. I say, okay, fine. And hopefully I have a stop method somewhere so we can say, hey, Jeff. I say, hey, what? He says, stop. And I stop before I fall off the side. It's a lot easier to do it that way than to be running the process all the time. So, a class. I mentioned classes a minute ago. This is another phrase you'll see all the time. And people kind of go, okay, what's an object class? I hear that word all the time. What does it mean? It's just the blueprint. An object class is the definition for an object. So anytime I use an object in a program, I can refer to the blueprint and say, okay, make me an object, a chair. And when I get that object, the blueprint tells me that the chair is going to have properties like color and number of legs and upholstered, which is a Boolean. And every time I use a chair within my program, I say, okay, I need a new chair. And I refer to that class and say, give me a new chair. And the class says, okay, here it is. And by the definition of the class, that chair has the properties and the methods, if any, that the class definition says the object has. So an object class is just the blueprint. An instance, on the other hand, is the object once we're using it in the program. Okay, so our program says, I need a new chair, so I will instantiate. There's another one of those lofty terms. I will instantiate a chair object. So all that means is read the object class, read the blueprint, create a data type of the type chair, and store it in whatever variable name I give it. Okay, so maybe I say my chair equals new chair. And so the language I'm working in says the new keyword says I'm creating a new object of the object class chair and saves it in the variable my chair. Okay? Clear so far? Make sense? Good. So it's not an object until we build it. It's a class. Okay? So you see lots of references to Java classes, and you see java.class files that you can download from wherever and put them in applications and so on. Those are those blueprints. Once you put them into your application, and at runtime you do something and run them, then you have an instance of the object that participates in the application running. Why use them at all? Because they're nice little scale models. Collections of objects can model systems really nicely, really cleanly. And the example I have up here is school, where we might have, think of the things that you see at a school, students, teachers, principal, school bus, whatever. Whatever the focus of our application happens to be will determine the selection of the things that we're going to model, what objects we want to have. The cool thing about objects is because of the way they're designed, that they are small and focused and nice and clean and atomic, they can be repurposed really easily. So we might have an application, our school model, for example, where we could pull out a class and stick it in a different system, a different model system, without modification or with very little modification. So, we might have a person object, for example, that might work at school or could be at home, and we could perhaps take that person object, modify it slightly to act as a student or as a teacher. Okay, this is what we refer to. Okay, I'll get back to this in just a second. When you take, using that person example, you take an object and you give it some additional characteristics, some additional properties or modified methods, we refer to it as extending an object, or extending an object class. So we might create a new class called student or teacher that extends person. And so what happens there is, that just tells me I'm supposed to be in here talking to you guys. Glad it's on time. So when you extend an object, all you're doing is saying, okay, take the blueprint for that object, the parent object. I'm going to do everything that blueprint says, and then I'm going to do a few other things. So subclasses, like student or teacher, are very simple because all they're doing is the few things that are very specific to being a student or very specific to being a teacher. So teacher might have a method that's like write on chalkboard, and student might have a method that says write down homework, you know, whatever it is that are particular to those things. But they're both people, so they're going to have all of those characteristics like eye color and hair color and all of those things that we already established as a person object. There's no reason for us to create that whole process, that whole structure over again for student and teacher. We can just say, take a person and add some things to it. So that's called extending the object. Okay. Objects, syntactically speaking, in the vast majority of OO languages, you'll have object name dot property. So if you see dot and something with no parens at the end, that means you're referring to a property of the object. And when you see object name dot method with parens, that means you're referring to a method, so something that the object's going to do. Okay. If you see the object type with a capital letter at the front, this is a convention again in most languages, that's referring to the class. Okay, so capital letter at the beginning, object class. Camel case typically means an instantiated object as opposed to the class. Buzzwords, what does all this stuff mean? Inheritance just means I am what my parent is. So a subclass has all the things that a parent has. So just like you inherit characteristics from your parents. Object languages are a little bit stricter than that, in that if your parent has it, you will have it. It's not you might get it from one or another. That's another discussion for a whole different day. Polymorphism. These are some of the buzzwords that when you get into OO stuff, you start seeing eyes roll back in heads, and people go, yeah, this is where I lost it in that book. Polymorphism just means I can react differently from other objects that have the same method. So, for example, we might have an animal object that has a method of eat. And we might have some animals that are herbivores and some animals that are carnivores. So you might have an eat method that just says, you know, ingest something, chew on it. The herbivore subclass might alter that method. It might have its own eat method that changes how that particular subclass responds to that method. So when I make the request of that object to do that method, it will respond differently depending on whether I'm talking to an herbivore or a carnivore, even though it's the same method, and I send the same message to it to do the thing. Okay, so this could become really flexible if I have a whole collection of, I have a zoo full of animals, right? It comes feeding time. I can just loop over my whole collection of animals and say, everybody eat. And everybody does what they're supposed to do according to their kind. I don't have to know as the procedure to say, take a bucket of oats over for the horse and take, you know, some raw meat over for the tigers and so on and so forth. I can just say, okay, everybody eat. A lot simpler. Okay, encapsulation means you can't make me as an object, I'm an object, have or do anything that I don't already have or know how to do. Now, you can violate this really easily, and most languages allow you to violate encapsulation. This is why it's a big topic of discussion at lots of developer conferences, is how to write better encapsulated code. and we could do hours and hours on approaches to this. But basically, all it means is, go back to my chair and changing its color. Procedurally speaking, what we would do is we would say, my chair dot color equals blue. It's done, right? And that makes perfect sense from a procedural perspective, and it'll work, and color will be changed, and so forth. But encapsulation says, in good practice, what we should really do is not affect that property directly, but we should ask that chair to change its color. We should send a message to it and say, hey, chair, change your color. Now, if the chair doesn't have a method that's change color, then it won't do it. And that's actually a good thing, because if the object isn't capable of doing that, then we want to know that. So we'll get an error back if we say, that object changed color, and or that chair, rather, dot change color. Java, for example, will throw back an error that says, you don't have that method available. You're not allowed to do that thing. So what happens is we create methods for the properties that correlate to the properties that an object has that are referred to as getters and setters. Getters just mean give me the property value back, and setters mean set the property to a new value. So I would say that chair dot set color, open paren blue, close paren. Okay, so I'm sending it the color I want it to change, and it says, oh, I have a change color method, so I will set my color property to blue. And now I can say, hey, chair, my chair dot get color, open paren, close paren, and it'll say, yes, I can answer that question for you. My color is blue. Okay. Now, I can still, in most languages, directly refer to my chair.color directly as a value, and I'll get back a valid response of blue. But the reason I don't want to do that, I want to use methods to do it, keep that encapsulation, is it allows the object to determine how it responds to requests. So, for example, before I start making up too many examples, let me see where I'm going next. Okay, I'll get to this in a minute. Let's say we have an employee object, and every employee has a property that is their biweekly pay. Okay. Now, an employee might be a salaried employee. An employee might be an hourly employee. Might be part-time, might be full-time, might have benefits or not have benefits. So all the things that contribute to what their biweekly pay rate are, there's a lot of stuff involved there. If I'm allowed to directly say, hey, object, what's your biweekly pay rate? Then all it can do, it has to have that property as a number. And it has to be set at some point so that I can pull it out. On the other hand, if I say, object, I'm going to use your get hourly pay rate or biweekly pay amount method, then it can have a whole procedure behind it that says, okay, I'm a salaried employee, I have these benefits coming out, I do this little calculation and so on and so forth, and give you back a number. When the process changes, I, as the requester of the information, need to know nothing about it. So I don't care where the number comes from or what's going on behind the scenes or how the object arrives with its response that it gives back to me. I don't have to change. Other aspects of the program that use that don't have to change. They're still just saying, give me this piece of information, and the object's returning that piece of information. Okay, so this is what encapsulation is all about. Instead of reaching into the object and pulling out its guts and saying, ah, I got it now, you're making a polite request and saying, may I have this? And the object does whatever it needs to do, unbeknownst to you, and says, give it back. Give you back that piece of information. So this is what encapsulation is all about. Okay? You think of it in terms of someone coming up and asking you for something as opposed to reaching into your pocket and taking it from you. Okay? That's really what it's all about. It's a conversation between objects rather than procedures controlling everything and saying, I will do it for you. Procedures are like the IRS. Anyway, how to think in terms of objects. when we're building objects, it's very, very helpful to think in the first person. So kind of put yourself in the shoes of the object and what it's going to do, how it's going to behave, what sort of things it has, what its characteristics are. Helps you to establish the properties and methods when you're devising an object class. You're coming up with a blueprint for that object. Think small. The methods are very small things. Procedures tend to be very big things. Okay, big confusing things. Objects small, not confusing. Nice tidy things. Okay, and think in terms of interaction. So, objects that work with each other, interaction amongst one another, as opposed to grand control scheme. Okay. How do we go about some of these things? Some illustrations just to talk about what I mean. For the gamers amongst you, some old screenshots here. Flying a plane is a first-person perspective, right? This is first-person. You're sitting in the seat. You're doing the stuff, right? So I am doing the things that I need to do. SimCity here, God's eye view is third-person perspective. You sit on top of everything. You see the world. You have to worry about all the stuff, right? So you're controlling everything, and you got your fingers in all the pies. So instead of being something and doing something for yourself, you're controlling everything else. Third person. All right, think small. David and Goliath, right? Everybody knows this story. David only worried about one task, the stone and where to throw it. Objects should be like this. Okay? Oh, Goliath here, he worried about all the other stuff, being the biggest, controlling the battle, so on and so forth. He had the whole thing. Objects should not be like this. Okay, we're not worried about all the surrounding stuff, just one thing at a time. Think in terms of interaction. Players interact to get work done. Objects should be like this. I could not do this presentation without having a Dilbert cartoon in it, of course. Can everybody read the boss there? Pointy-eared bosses oversee everything. Objects should not be like this. Can you guys read that? Yes, no, maybe? Yes? Our goal is to force customers to form support groups. Over time, with luck, we'll train customers to do our manufacturing and shipping, too. That's a manager's approach. That's a procedure that would indeed control everything and doesn't have a very high likelihood of success. So, a quick example, procedural example. Procedure does the work. Data types are passive participants. So what I want to look at here, if I can get to it. All right. Again, I'm going through a split screen here stuff. So, all right. So, I want to show you a little bit of code. If I can manage it on my split screen here. Where's my mouse? Here we go. Okay, so some procedural code. I have a feed pets process, which, can you guys read that? No. Bad programmer. Okay, let's try this. Find mouse. Not sure which I'm hooked to here. Yes, this will work. I get it on your screen for you. All right. Stop me when you can read it. Yeah? Okay. So here we're setting up a procedure. We're gonna feed the pets. So we're creating a dog structure. His name is Spot. His weight is 20. He's hungry. He eats Purina dog chow. He eats 2 cups a meal. His bark volume is loud, and his bark frequency is intermittent. Then we're creating a cat, another cat. It's a structure. His name's Snowballs. He's 9 pounds. He's hungry. Meow mix, 1 cup per meal, and has a high water aversion. And we have a fish named Jaws. His weight is 0.0001 pounds. He's hungry. He eats omega-1 freshwater flakes, 1 shake per meal, and has dorsal spines. All right, so now we're going to feed the dog. So first thing we're going to do is set the dog's hungry to false. And then we're going to compute the dog's new weight based on his meal. So we have dog's weight plus 0.25 pound. And I say over here, note the use of data external to the thing. So we've got some hard-coded data here, right, in the process. Okay? And we're going to output dog's name has been fed, the amount per meal of whatever the food is, and so on. And we have a cat, feed the cat process again, same kind of deal. Right? This is really straightforward code, and you've probably written lots of stuff like this. Everybody's written lots of stuff like this at some point or another. And so when we run the feed pets procedure, we see that Spot has been fed 2 cups of dog chow and weighs 20.25 pounds. And Snowball's been fed a cup of Yamix and weighs 9.025 pounds. And Jaws has been fed 1 shake of Omega-1 freshwater flakes and weighs something more than he weighed before. And we have these structures down here that show each one of the animals. So here we've got Spot here and Snowball here and Jaws here that are just structures dumped out. Okay? Really straightforward stuff. Everybody gets it. Okay. So, then, I want to go back and take you to the next thing. Do I have enough things on screen at once? Okay, here we go. Okay, so the thing to note here is the procedure does all the work, right? So going through that process, you could see all of that stuff happening. Data types are passive participants. They don't do anything at all other than be there for the procedure to control. Okay. Now what I want to show you is something that I refer to as pseudo-OO. Hal and I have talked about it on the podcast on occasion as poo. This is where we use objects not as objects. Okay, so we're actually creating objects, and so in cold fusion we're using CFCs. We're building things that look like objects, but we're not using them. We're not orienting to the objects. We're still using a procedural orientation. Okay, and that looks like poo. All right, what are we doing here? We have some CFCs, and we have a CFM, and our index CFM just calls this feed pets CFM. All right, so these. All right. These objects we create. So we're creating a component, okay, no output, and we're giving it a bunch of attributes. These are the same attributes we saw when we used the structure, right? So the same kind of deal, and we're just creating this as a class, if you will. So all of the properties are empty. And the cat and the fish are similar. And so what our feed pets process does is very similar. In fact, it's exactly the same. The only thing that we're doing is using a CF object declaration here instead of a struct new, right? So in cold fusion, CFCs really are a lot like structures, syntactically speaking. It's just that they have methods as well as just data. So we can not have any methods in a component in cold fusion and just use it just like we did a structure. And so we have this different declaration to create the variable called spot. And from there on, we're doing exactly the same thing we did before. This is not OO. There's no orientation to the object here at all. This is simply using a cold fusion component as a data type and continuing to do our procedural thing. All right? The process has very similar result in terms of our actual output up here. It's exactly the same. What we have in terms of data is slightly different in that these are components instead of structures. Okay, and we can see the type that they are. This just shows the path to the CFC that I used, and it shows that it's got those same properties on it. Okay, so we have succeeded in using CFCs. Thank you. This is obviously not what we would like you to do. Okay, so procedure's still doing all the work here, right? CFCs are used, program isn't written from their orientation, and data types are still passive participants. So we got to get them active. So we're going to take the same example, and we're going to look at it in terms of OO. So we go back a wee little bit. Now we have some CFCs that are a little bit different. All right, so this thing, we have a dog. and no output. Here's something interesting, though. It extends PET. Now, notice here that we have a bunch of stuff in here to set up. Name, weight, hungry food, amount per meal. These first several, we'll see in a second, they're actually defined within the PET data type. This is one of the things I don't care for about Cold Fusion, is that if you do a subclass, you're forced to create the arguments in that subclass that are in the parent class, if you want to use the parent's a parent's init function. I have an init function in the parent class. This is extending that function, but I still have to declare all of the arguments in the subclass, which is not typical of a lot of languages, but that's why they're here. Then when you make requests of the object, it'll throw errors on you. You won't get the behavior you want. The important thing here is that our dog has a bark volume and bark frequency, which a pet does not have. Okay, so when we create this thing, we're going to do super.init. Super just means my parent, the class that I extend. Okay, so this has super pet up there, has an init function, and I'm going to pass it all of the name, weight, hungry, and food and amount per meal that I got into my init, pass it to my parent, get the result from that, and so on. Okay, and then I'm going to set bark volume and bark frequency to whatever were passed in when this object was created. When it was instantiated. Yes?
How can I tell looking at
that which ones you had put in there again? Show you in just a second. That's why we're looking at the parent now. Okay. Two ways. So if we look in here, we see that we have name, weight, hungry, food, and amount per meal as arguments to this init function. Okay? Now, I also have down here some functions other than init. So I have eat, I have get name, I have get amount per meal, get weight, get food. Okay? So all of the subclasses inherit these methods, and so they all have them. That's why you don't see them in the dog definition, because they already exist up here. So a dog automatically has a method to eat, and it does some things where it sets its own weight to whatever the new weight is using the properties that were set up when you instantiate the object. Okay? Get name returns its own name. Get amount per meal. So this is where we're returning those properties with methods. These are the getters that I talked about before. And they're traditionally named get something or other. Okay? And get food. So to go back to the dog real quickly to answer your question. The primary way I know that these first several arguments I have there because the parent has them is because I'm calling them here in a parent init. Okay, so I'm using super init to do that. Now, if I don't need to call any of the parent's functions from, I'm not trying to what we call overload a method. Overloading simply means you create a method of the same name as the parent and do something in addition to what the parent does. So if I don't have to do that, then this is kind of a moot point. But because I want to have my own init method that calls the parent's init method, then I have to have this pass-through capability in here. This is peculiar to Cold Fusion. In most most languages, I wouldn't have to have all of this in here. I could just say super init, take all of these things that were thrown in, and then do these two things. So it would be a simpler definition in here. But that's just a variant of the language. It's not really a critical concept. Okay, here's the big deal. Yeah? I don't know. I have no insight into that whatsoever. All right, so now here's our new controller program for this whole thing. We're creating, first I want to do a structure called pets. This is for my convenience as the pet owner. I want to be able to handle them as a group. I finally succeeded in herding cats. No. So then I want to create Spot as a member of pets. He's going to be create an object. It's a CFC of type dog. And I'm going to run my init method right away. with these values. Spot, 20 pounds, he's hungry, Purina dog chow, all that stuff we saw before, right? I'm just going to throw all those into this instantiation. Okay, so this line that uses create object is called an instantiation. So that creates our spot object, then we have our snowball object, same kind of deal, and our jaws object, same kind of deal. Very simple declarations, right? Now I'm going to feed the pets. This is where it gets much, much simpler. So instead of all of that calculation and other stuff that we had in the procedure, and we were using embedded data and all that kind of stuff, we now just have a loop. We're going to loop over the collection of pets, refer to each one as this pet within this little loop of code. And all I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, for this pet in my pets collection, eat. And they're all going to respond to that according to their kind and what they eat and how much they eat and all that kind of stuff. And then I'm going to say, okay, I need to know some other stuff. What's your name? Put it in pet name. How much do you eat per meal? What kind of food do you eat? And how much is your weight now that you've been fed? And I'm just going to output a statement that says, this pet's been named this, that, and the other thing. Okay? So I'm going to do all of that. Now I have a little script down here that says, okay, run that function. Feed the pets. Okay? And I'll dump the results of it. So if I go back to our browser, I go to that example, it runs it, and the result is exactly the same in terms of the output. But what's going on behind the scenes is a little bit different. Here's our pet struct, and we have Jaws up top. He's a component of type fish. Here's all of his stuff. Oh, wait, look, he has an init function. He has a getName function, a getAmountPerMeal function, an eat function, method, I should be saying. All these functions are methods. Eat, get food, get weight, right? So he inherited all of those methods from the pet class, right? Same deal with Snowball and with Spot. Okay, now comes the really, 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 really cool part, I hope. That was pretty cool right there. Wait till you get this part. See these down here? I love this part. Because now that we've done all of this stuff and we have this really simple process that we've put all together in this little procedure called feed pets that calls all of these objects and lets them do their thing, we can do it over and over and over again without copy and paste, right, all that procedure, or stick that whole big long procedure in a loop to do it, you know, however many times. We can call it as many times as we want to. And every time it occurs, it does all of the things that the different animals do, takes care of them. It's all within the objects themselves. The procedure is not making any of these definitions, any of these controlling decisions, okay? So data types are now active participants in the process, right? The objects are doing things for themselves. They're not being controlled. The main program just establishes the objects, instantiates them from their class definitions, and asks them to work. Tells them to do their thing. Okay, sends a message, says, okay, eat. Whoops, whoa. Okay. Data types show inheritance, polymorphism, and encapsulation. All of those things were in there. Did you catch them as they went by? So we had inheritance, right, where the dog and the cat and the fish all inherited from the pet class. We had polymorphism in the init method, where we overloaded the init method in each of the subclasses so that they could do things differently or in addition to the superclasses in it. And they each had their own particular eat. Okay, so eat was defined in the pet. If we wanted to alter how the subclasses responded to eat, we could do that as well within their subclass definitions. Okay, so polymorphism all through there. And encapsulation, we had getters and setters for the data types. So when we asked for the pet's name, we didn't say directly return spot.name. We said set a variable to spot.getName, open paren, close paren, and then referred to that variable, okay? So just requesting for the name. We could directly refer to spot.getName, open paren, close paren within hash marks as though it were, you know, a variable per se. And it's effectively the same thing. It's just asking the object to give us that piece of data and send it back. All right, cool. What I would like you to leave with, now that we're inside the final 5 minutes, surprise, surprise, no fear of objects, okay? These are not scary things. They're just tools to be used and really enjoyed. You kind of, once you get into playing with them and tinkering with them, they really are a lot of fun because they're just simple, they're straightforward, and it's fun to model stuff, frankly. Take away the basic terminology so when you look at other references, you read books or whatever, you know what we're talking about. So nothing mysterious there. And a proper perspective for object-oriented programming, which really is just, it's another way of doing things. All you're doing is changing your orientation from third person to first person, right? So it really is that easy. Questions? Yes? Subclass, yes. If you define a subclass, it inherits all of the properties and methods of its parent, by definition. That's what a subclass is. Okay? So if I say dog extends pet, automatically I know that the dog is going to have all of the methods and properties that the pet class has. Okay? This? Okay, great question. What does this mean? What is this thing? What is this? This is simply a keyword that refers to the object itself. Okay, and within a class, when you write a CFC, it's a way to say, for any instance of this object, I can refer to my own properties or methods. Okay, so for a getter, for example, I have a getter that says get name. I would have a CF return in there that just says return this dot name. So return this object property called name. Now it doesn't matter if I instantiate, a Jeff and a David and a Bob. Jeff's going to respond to this dot name by saying Jeff's name. Bob's going to respond to it by saying Bob's name. David's going to respond to it by saying David's name. Okay? It's a way within a class to refer to the object that will at some point be instantiated. That any clearer? Okay, good. There was one over here. Where was it? Bob?
Can you, I realize it's a little, maybe a 102 instead of 101.
Events and listeners really have more to do with the invocation style of the program than objects per se. Okay, listeners are simply a way to monitor things that go on within an application and respond to events. So, for example, I'll just use Windows as an example. You have a browser window, and you've got a menu across the top, so you can have mouse clicks on the menu. You can have, mouse down is an event, mouse up is an event, on click is an event, if we deal in JavaScript and so forth. So listeners are just a way to establish that when this event happens, or whatever event happens, the following things happen. Okay, so when you have a structure, and this really doesn't have so much to do with OO as it does with the invocation system within an application. All it is saying that you establish listeners for a particular event. When that event fires, then everything that is listening for it will happen as a result. Okay? That's really not even 102. It's sort of application architecture as opposed to OO. Yeah. Okay, yeah, let me make this really clear. What's happening there is not... they're clapping, I got to get out of here. What's happening in this CFC is not that the variables aren't created. This is defining, the arguments are defining what gets passed in, what we can accept as arguments when this object is instantiated. I have to redefine them in the subclass for Cold Fusion so that down here when I do super init, I can pass them along to this init that takes the same string of arguments. In some languages, I wouldn't have to do all of these lines. I would just have these two lines that are specific to the subclass, and yet I would still be able to say super init, take all of the things in the signature of the declaration and pass them back to the parent. Okay, the properties are still there in the definition. They've been created from the parent. This is just the definition of the arguments that can be passed into the create object statement when you instantiate the object. Yeah, and then I'm over here. Yes. Let me know when you got a week to spare. This is one of the discussions, ongoing discussions in the OO world about, you know, kind of the esoterica between, how far do you take an object hierarchy? And one of the things that I will tell you is kind of try to avoid trying to create subclass hierarchies for everything, because that's a rabbit trail that you can go down and really kind of get yourself into corners that are not easy to get out of. So be judicious in your application of extending classes using subclasses. Yes. Uh huh. Yep, it is. You're going to run into, like I said before, you're never going to escape entirely from procedures. Okay. Now, this is because I'm dealing in Cold Fusion here. If we're dealing in a purely OO world, in a language like Java or Ruby or something else, you have a class that is the controller for the application. It's usually named something like main. Okay? And this is the thing that when you start the program, that's what causes everything else to happen. Okay? So at some level, and it has its main function is just a procedure that starts the interaction with other objects. Okay? From there, much depends on the application architecture in terms of, like Bob was talking about, if you implement, you know, events and listeners and things like that, it's more the job of the application architecture to sort out how all of that stuff is happening with user interaction and so forth. But at some point at the top of the program, there is a procedure of some kind that gets the ball rolling. Perhaps, sure, yeah, and you know, those things are all definitely things to explore. Yeah. Thinking objects, yeah, that is a good one. Man, there's just bazillions of references out there, and I'm trying to think. What's the one? I've lost the name of the series that O'Reilly did, Head First, thank you. Yeah, Head First Job is an excellent book. Really tremendous. Totally different from any book you'll ever read. And there it is in the back. Excellent, good, that's what it looks like. The Head First series, tremendous stuff. It'll make you go, wait a minute, they've totally changed what books are all about. So they're definitely worthwhile. Cool. Anything else? They're opening the doors and ushering us out, and someone else is going to be up here to kick me off the podium any second. So thanks for your time. Please fill out the surveys. And thank you.